Hello and welcome to Hollywood for Writers. I'm Donna Guest Cause. Some people refer to me as Dan. My guest today is Linda Sager, now spelled S-E-G-E-R, but pronounced Sager. She is a script consultant, screenwriting coach, and keynote speaker. She is the author of 9 books on screenwriting, including Making a Good Script Great, and the one we're going to talk about today, Creating Unforgettable Characters. So Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Now, before we get started on the topic itself, tell us a little bit about your background and some of the people you've worked with.
Well, I started my script consultant business in 1981, and I had a big background in theater, and I had a lot of degrees. I actually created my business based on my doctoral thesis, and perhaps I'm one of the few people that actually made money off their doctoral thesis.
Okay.
But I wrote about what are the elements that make a great script and what goes wrong with scripts that are not great. Then I started teaching my methods and teaching my ideas, and have been doing that really since the mid-1980s, and then my first book came out in 1988. So I've been in drama a long, long time, and I've worked with some really interesting people. I actually worked with Peter Jackson on his third film, which was called Brain Dead. And if you watch him get the Academy Award for Lord of the Rings, he said my first two films were unwatchable, which was true. But his third one that I worked with him on broke him out into the international field. And I also worked with Roland Emmerich on his first breakthrough film, which was Universal Soldier. And then later I worked with Bill Kelly. I didn't work with him on Witness, but I worked with him on some scripts after Witness. And so I've had quite a broad background, ranging from very beginning writers to very experienced writers and award-winning writers. So it's been a lovely career.
It sounds like, and you're a very prolific writer yourself. Now, the book we're going to be talking about today is Creating Unforgettable Characters. First of all, what is an unforgettable character?
There are two elements you always look for. One is that the character has direction. That is, they are moving the story forward toward the climax, and they are influential in making that climax happen. So they are not bystanders or observers. And another thing is that a character has dimension. So I think a character's, in terms of three dimensions, is they think, they act, and they feel. So you look at the way the characters make decisions, what their value structures and values and attitudes are, and what they do, because it's important that they do something, and then to make sure that there is a really wide emotional range, because if the character doesn't feel, the audience doesn't feel. So we have to empathize and sympathize and find the character fascinating and engaging. So there's a lot of elements to characters
okay.
Creating an unforgettable one.
Now, who are some of the unforgettable characters that come to mind for you?
Well, if you go back just historically, Lucy, of course. I love Lucy. And I think the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Mary and Rhoda, they just have stood out for years and years and years, and they are so detailed and they are so specific. And that's another thing we look for in characters, that they are not kind of vague. You don't just say he's good-looking or she's good-looking. It's all those little intricacies that become important. Another one of my favorite characters is Sam Gerard in The Fugitive. I find him absolutely fascinating. And this year, I think some of the best characters are Dallas Buyers Club. Matthew McConaughey has just broken through this year into doing serious roles. His character is absolutely marvelous, along with that supporting character who's up for an Academy Award and who very well might win it as well. So there are some great ones that just stand out.
Okay. Now, are we talking about creating unforgettable lead characters, protagonists, or all the characters?
We're talking about everybody. So a protagonist should have a lot of dimension, and they should have a lot of detailing around their, around their particular character, that you see them, you kind of get them very quickly, and then you find out more and more information about them. For instance, they should be, we should have a very good sense of their context. That is, what is the world and the environment that they live in, and how they do they interact with their world? What is their vocabulary? And vocabulary tells us a lot about a character. For instance, does a character go into a pub, a tavern, the lobby lounge, the beer hall? You know, different characters, that's going to tell us a lot about different kinds of characters, just that little thing. And we look at the period. For instance, a character in the 1800s is going to be quite different than a character in 2013 or 2014. So there's got to be a lot of detailing around the protagonist, but then the antagonist is generally also a major character. And we should have a really good sense of what the motivation is. It's really easy for people to get into stereotypes, especially with antagonists, the evil bad guy with the mustache and the black hat, and or the mobster who uses a lot of foul language and is always shooting a gun, and you know, the thugs. All of these can just fall right into a cliche. But the other thing to look at, who are the minor characters? Who are the people that we might only meet for a moment, like the waitress, the clerk in the shop, the receptionist at the hotel? And those are wonderful opportunities to shade a character with certain language and maybe an accent sometimes, or they're tall, they're short, they're fat, they're skinny, they're black, they're white, they're Hispanic, they're Pakistani. I mean, just something is to not miss the opportunity to have small characters that stand out as well. Two of my favorite characters in terms of small characters, if you go back to The Fugitive. Now, I know The Fugitive was a long time ago, but I think that is just a marvelous movie. And there is the woman that owns the little apartment that Richard Kimball rents, and she was just kind of taken off the strip. She was not a professional actress. She came in the first day to start shooting her scenes, and she was chewing gum, and the director said, "Keep it." So I think she's a marvelous little character, and there's a marvelous little character there that works at night in the hospital, and she works with these prosthetic limbs. And she is just so cute, and she's just so perky, and there she is, very, very intent on her work. But it just shows you can take a small character and make them very memorable and very unforgettable.
Yeah, I think that can make the overall story that much richer to have these characters that we can't forget. So one thing that you advocate in your book is during research, that kind of begs the question, well, if we're just making them up, why do we need to do research on them?
Well, every character exists in a very specific world, and they have very specific qualities. And if somebody starts writing a policeman, for instance, and they haven't been around policemen, they might get it all wrong. They might have all the details wrong. Many years ago, I actually did a seminar for police that did media, and I walked in and I said to them, well, the only thing I know about policemen is that they drink coffee and eat donuts. And everyone glared at me, and it was clear that that cliche was probably not exactly true. And
yeah. So
you need to know all those little details that differentiate people's occupation, the location. For instance, where do you live? Do you live in a big city? Do you live in a little town? That is going to make a big difference in your character. And if you put a big city character in a little town, and have never been to a little town, that character's not going to be accurate, and they're not going to ring true. I grew up in a little town in northern Wisconsin, and many times when I read about little towns and characters, I think they just have never been there. People know each other, and they relate to each other, and you have a lot of interesting little rituals that little towns do, that characters take part in. And it is a different world than the big city. I've lived in Los Angeles, and I've lived in Chicago. So you need to research locations. Another thing you research is occupation, that every occupation has insider language. It has different clothes that people wear. It has different things people drink. So I live in Colorado now. I had a horse for 10 years, who I no longer have, but I did horse shows, and I did cowboy stuff, Western stuff, and I just thought all cowboys drink beer, and I learned that most cowboys like Crown Royal. And so we get these stereotypes about certain groups of people, and if we don't do our research on our characters, they are simply not accurate.
Now, let's talk about revealing character. I've read a lot of screenplays by beginning screenwriters, and they seem to have a really tough time revealing backstory and revealing characters, where they want to indicate, well, this is John who knows Mary and loved her for 30 years, and his brother-in-law does this, that, and the other. You can do this in a novel, but you cannot do this in a screenplay. Am I correct?
No. This is called the backstory. And sometimes what people do to show backstory is they decide to do a flashback. So they say, well, the person grew up in a middle-class home, so we're going to flashback to the age of 5 doing something middle-class, like having a middle-class dinner around the the
yeah.
table. And say,
you in a small town. So, yeah.
Yeah, you don't need to do that. And another thing is that people then reveal backstory by getting chatty. So they have what I call the date scenes. Where are you from? Well, I'm from northern Wisconsin. Well, where are you from? I'm from Chicago. Where'd you go to school? And all of a sudden, it's nothing but chat, and they're trying to get a sense of backstory. But one way to get a sense of backstory is to use props that the character uses. So, for instance, I'm married. And if you met me, you would see a wedding ring. That is implied backstory. And it says that you don't have to give a whole history of my relationship with Peter and our wedding and all of this, because I have a wedding ring on, and that is an implied backstory. Sometimes people have photos in a room, and you say, got it, the person was in the service because I see a photo of that person in uniform. You don't have to go on and on about telling me when or where. Just show me a good photo. Or sometimes you get implied backstory because of actions that people take. So, for instance, let's say that a woman character is reaching for a glass on the second shelf of her cupboard, and some guy is, maybe her husband or somebody else, starts to reach for it at the same time, and she cringes. And you think, has this guy been beating up on her? Is she an abused woman because of how she reacted to maybe just the man reaching out? But it says she's used to being hit. So if you can find an action that implies something in the past, or sometimes a phrase rather than a whole paragraph, like remember when we were kids and I was 13 and you were 14 and we went to the, keep it short. Well, we used to do this all the time up at the lake when we were kids. You don't have to do 5 sentences or 3 paragraphs. Is to say, if it's essential to know that backstory, give us a phrase, the least amount of dialogue to get it across. A lot of times backstory is not essential. we presume of 20, if somebody is 21 years old, that they had a childhood. You don't have to talk about it and discuss that. We presume it, and that they had parents, and we probably don't need to know much about those parents unless that information is really relevant.
Yeah, and another thing is you've mentioned dialogue in a couple contexts here. I think a lot of people, I guess new screenwriters, they tend to make the dialogue a little long, a little talky. Is that something that you find as well?
Yes, it's called on the nose.
Okay.
On the nose dialogue is people say exactly what they mean, and there is no subtext, there is no shading to it. They just simply state it. But what you really want with dialogue is a revelation of the character, and that many times you're going to have subtext, which might mean the person actually says the opposite of what they really mean. So if somebody says, what's wrong, and you say nothing, you think, no, something is really wrong. No, it's fine, I'm fine. And now we know that there is subtext to what I just said.
Right.
So one of the things you're looking for is really rich dialogue that resonates. And that means for the writer that the writer writes and rewrites and rewrites the same scene. I was talking to a friend of mine who was the first woman to ever win an Emmy Award for sitcom writing. Her name is Treva Silverman. And I said, how often do you rewrite? And she says, well, this morning I rewrote the scene 22 times.
She says,
I just hone that dialogue. I read it out loud. I get the rhythm of it. I change the word that I'm using because there's a better word choice that reveals character better. And I might decide to shorten it and get to the point faster, or I might decide to start earlier in the scene in order to get a little more character nuance. And you just work and rework and rework and rework. So I think what happens with new writers, that they simply state it and they don't understand that's the first draft, and now you keep working with it. And
okay.
Dialogue is really like music. It has a rhythm, and that people from different places in the country have different rhythms to their speech. So obviously, if you're doing a Southern character, you might slow it down a little bit. And if you're doing a Northern character, they might say, look, let's just meet at the corner drugstore. Got it. I'll see you there at 3.
Yeah,
all of a sudden, you're okay, got it. And so there, and many times what you're looking for in dialogue is to catch the flavor of a part of the country, but not so strongly that we can't understand it. So
right.
Sometimes what people do is that they create their dialogue and they caught the accent, but now we don't know what they're talking about. And so the big thing is, what's the flavor? How do I get into that feel? So if you're doing a period piece, say, how do I get a flavor for Shakespeare's time, but don't have everyone talking in iambic pentameter and have everyone saying words that say, I don't have any idea what they're talking about.
Right. Yeah, I've seen this when sometimes people try to recreate accents, but they actually spell the words as they might be pronounced. That actually gets to be very cumbersome reading. Would you agree with that?
Yes, because that's the other thing. You have to write a script that people want to read, because
yeah.
It's hard to sell a script that's unreadable. So you want to keep the flow, and of course, characters don't have long speeches, so generally in movies, we think a dialogue like a tennis ball, is that it goes into one court for two sentences and another for one, and then it goes to the other one for a phrase, and then the other person says, yeah, and then it goes back. And so you keep it going, and that's another thing that can change, because sometimes people in real life tell long stories, and they take over the floor to have their speeches, get on their soapbox. And in movies, dialogue is short, and you got to get across that character very quickly.
Yeah. Now, we've just barely scratched the surface of your book, Tell us a little bit about some of the other chapters and topics that you cover.
Well, let's see. I know I talk about research. I think at Chenality and Thematic. We are thinking of redoing that book as a 25th anniversary edition. It's been it came out in 1990. It's been quite successful, and I just kind of want to add some things and talk further about some of the subject matter that I talk in there. But certainly characters express themes. If your theme is about greed for the whole script, then you better have some greedy characters. Yet you don't want them to be total cliches. And you look at character relationships. I have a chapter in there on the non-human character. Like, how do you make Lassie or Seabiscuit or Secretariat as interesting characters? And my feeling was that Secretariat and Seabiscuit were not as interesting as they could have been, and that the writers maybe didn't know enough about horses, because horses can be extremely expressive, and there are very specific things that horses do to show you they're relaxed and that they're happy and that they're angry and that they're frustrated. And I've been on a horse once where somebody said, "Don't do that. The horse is getting really angry at you." And I did it, and the horse ran into the barn with me. I mean, he just took off. And I said, "Oops, I guess, you know, I should have been more aware of what he was communicating to me." and stop it, you know. So there are a lot of movies with animals where the animals are not as good of characters as they might be able to be. And that means that the writer has to understand how animals communicate their own special characters, and even the difference between a mean cat and a really nice cat, or even animals that might get depressed. And I've worked on a number of scripts with animals. I even worked on one with a dragon once, and I said, "Your dragon is not expressive. It's not telling us anything about a character." So I started doing notes about how do you create a dragon character. And okay, although I didn't know a lot about dragons, I've never met one, I knew about horses, I knew about cats, I knew about dogs. And so I started giving this person ideas of how that animal has a tail and has a head and has ears and all the different things that you could use to start being expressive of emotions. And just even, you know, animals can be cute. So you think about all your characters in a script, from the major to the minor to the animals, if you have any. And sometimes it's not a bad idea to have an animal, because an animal is not only its own character, but it helps dimensionalize the characters around it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I had not thought about creating characters out of animals. We see it a lot in animation, of course, but not in live action. So that's very good information. Well, Linda, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people how they can find you and your books.
My website is lindasager.com, real easy, S-E-G-E-R. And it also lists all my books, and my email is lssager, for Linda Sue Sager, a good Midwestern name, lssager@aol.com. And so that has information about all my books and all my script consulting services and my seminar schedule, in case I come somewhere near your listeners and they want to come to a seminar.
Excellent. So, Linda, thank you so much for being on the show. You're giving us some great information today.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so long. Bye.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.